Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I have chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. The show is also rebroadcast at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, so you can catch it then if your friends haven't heard it today. You can stream the show and every KRFY show at krfy.org from anywhere in the world, and it is available by podcast at krfy.org or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. The medical topics discussed here will feature the medical designations for each month. Since this is July, today's show features National Ultraviolet or UV Awareness Month, a very, very important topic for all those who live in this amazing summer and winter playground here in North Idaho. I have two guests here with me today, Richard Fligger, PhD, CAQ, Derm. That's a lot of letters, a lot of alphabet soup. And Mary Fiedler, who's a nurse practitioner at Women's Health District, in Women's Health at the Panhandle Health District. Why don't you introduce yourselves, Richard and Mary?
I'm Rich Fligger. I was trained at the University of Iowa, where I got my medical training, and my PhD at Toral College. Served in the Air Force, which is how I landed in the Northwest. A colleague of mine started his practice up here in North Idaho, and invited me to come practice with him. He made me a deal I couldn't refuse. And I've been practicing here since 1996. I'm a fellow of the SDPA, which is the PA organization for dermatology PAs, and serve on the editorial board of their journal.
Oh, great. And Mary, how about you?
I've been with the health district since 1994. I've been a nurse practitioner since 1998. And I love working in the public health field because it's mainly focuses on prevention, which is part of what hopefully the take-home message will be today as far as preventing skin changes and skin cancer and things we can do for that.
So, wonderful. We are so excited that you're here. And now I want to introduce Susie Perez. I call her my executive producer because she runs the board and keeps us on time. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, Dr. Joanne. And I just want our listeners to know that Medical Musing has already gained many listeners. The subjects are timely and the interviews are really interesting. So thanks for being a vital and informative medical information source for the KRFY listeners. And I want the listeners to know a little bit about you. Dr. Joanne is a longtime volunteer KRFY broadcaster, previously broadcasting DJ Otto's Eclectic Mix when she's in town, and now hosting your very own show, Medical Musing with Dr. Joanne, which airs, as you said previously, the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. So who is Dr. Joanne? Good question. Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010, previously worked as a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years, and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics. As the medical spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, she contributed to print, online media, radio, and television, so you have that background. And you have a medical and broadcast experience and expertise. You are also a mother of four adult children, and we feel fortunate to have your show as part of our Monday morning programming here at KRFY. And again, I'll just remind the listeners, you can stream us at krfy.org, or you can find the podcast of today's show or all of the Medical Musing shows at the same place, krfy.org.
Thank you, Susie. I'm going to start with a little history and science first, and then we'll dive into the clinical aspects of ultraviolet UV protection. We all see the SPF on all the different sunscreens we buy. So just to let you know, the sunscreen rating system was developed in 1962 by a man named Franz Greider. It's a measure of the sunscreen's ability to block the UV rays. You've probably heard that if it's the SPF of 15, means that it theoretically takes 15 times longer to burn than it would without any sunscreen. Again, and it follows SPF 30, 30 times longer, etc. Unfortunately, we don't want you to decide, okay, well, I'll slather this 15 on and stay out forever, because that really isn't going to be as helpful as you think. In 1992, Canada developed the UVI, which is the ultraviolet index. And by 1994, the National Weather Service, WHO, adopted the UVI. But it took until 2008 for the American Academy of Ophthalmology to designate July as UV Safety Awareness Month. You can find your UVI probably on some of your weather apps, just like you can find the AQI when we have those smoky days. Ultraviolet radiation causes the damage from the sun. It's present not only in sun's rays, but in x-rays and CT scans. So I know parents are always worried about how their children might be getting too much radiation. The x-ray tech gives the patient a lead apron, and then they leave the room. So they know that they don't want to be around it. Although UV radiation is invisible, it can cause lots of damage in the form of sunburn, skin cancer, aging, or signs of sun's damage, and eye disease, such as cataracts and macular degeneration. During the recent eclipses, eye safety was really emphasized. We have UVA rays, which are not absorbed by the ozone layer. They penetrate deeply and cause premature aging, so ladies stay out of the sun. These rays are constant all year round and are strong even on cloudy days. I remember hearing that when I was a teenager, and I never really believed it, because we just would be outside all the time. Tanning beds are all mainly UVA. UVB rays are partially absorbed by the ozone layer, and their intensity varies throughout the day. But again, being strongest between, we used to say 10 and 2, but now with daylight savings, I think I have to say 11 to 3. And that damage, again, burns the outer layer of the skin. Sunburns are very uncomfortable, thickens the skin, and can damage the eyes. We'll be talking about specifically the skin cancers that UV rays might cause, or do cause, later in the program. We also have UVC rays, and these don't penetrate the Earth's layer, but they're available in heat lamps or sun lamps and lasers. And again, I knew lots of teenagers who fell asleep under their sun lamp and ended up with terrible burns. Let's talk about sun protection so we can all decrease our risk of skin cancer and still enjoy the many outdoor pursuits here in North Idaho year-round. So, Richard, what do you tell your patients about sun protection?
Well, sun protection is one of those things that ought to be a daily a daily thing. Sometimes we think in terms of, well, I'm going to go out and I'm going to go to the beach. I'm going to go to Disneyland. I'm going to, and that's when I'll put on my sunscreen. But most of the time, people are exposed intermittently, walking from your car into the grocery store or to the dry cleaners or to the bank, whatever. And it's this intermittent exposure that seems to cause the bulk of the damage that we see. So putting it on every day, or at least taking some sort of measure, either by avoidance or wearing clothing that's unprotective, is probably more important than I would say that the bulk of the way we think about it. Now, obviously, if you're going to be going out and doing those things, people are going to remember, and please do, because that one burning sunburn that blisters is enough to increase your skin cancer risk by almost double.
Okay. So we hear about sunscreens and sunblocks. Can you tell us a little bit about the difference?
Well, in terms of the way that people actually talk about it, there isn't a whole lot of difference. Sunscreen, technically speaking, sunblocks are the inert or inorganic sunscreens or sun protectant ingredients, whereas sunscreens are going to be the chemical or organic ingredient types.
So those are the ones that make you white or purple or whatever color that happens to be.
The sunblocks. The sunblocks.
In the sun. Yeah,
the sunblocks. Yes, the sunblocks do. Zinc oxide, which is the main ingredient in most of these, has been used as a sunblock since before Civil War times. But the problem is that it always went on and made you look like a French mime, and people didn't like that very much, in addition to the smell or the stickiness that tends to go along with it. So until they came up with micronized zinc oxide and nanoparticle subtype, where it started to go much less opaque, that's when it really came into its own. That was in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, my understanding that the block deflects the UVA radiation versus the sunscreen creates a film that absorbs the UV radiation before it penetrates the skin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so there's a difference on how correct. One of them absorbs it or reflects it and re-radiates it as heat, whereas the other one chemically changes it as it absorbs
The sunscreen chemically changes it, and the block with zinc just doesn't let it come in at all. We do tell people to reapply every 2 hours or get out of the sun.
Correct.
And it's interesting what you said, Richard, because my husband, when he started, we all started thinking more about sun damage, he would put sunscreen on when he went to work in the office. So again, that time going in and out of the car or doing this or doing that, he is very, very faithful. We don't recommend using on infants under 6 months. Parents will always say, oh, I can't do anything. It's like, no, you can put your child with the back to the sun. You can have a shade on and make sure they're not getting overheated. But, basically, or bouncing the child around with a hat on. Yeah. Mary.
And I just want to say one more thing, too, as far as correct application is you want to apply it prior to, like 15 minutes to 30 minutes prior to going out. So it does create that preventative film. Protective film layer.
Do each one of you have favorite brands?
I do not, but I knew you were going to ask this question, Dr. Joanne. So I actually asked someone, a friend of mine who is a nurse practitioner in aesthetic medicine, and she loved, it's a Sun Better Advanced Mineral Protection by Skin Better Science. She uses 70 SPF. I think generally, and actually, Rich, you can jump in, but generally we recommend just at least using 30 as the standard.
Yeah, 30 is sort of the baseline.
Yeah, that's kind of what I did, too. Is that what you recommend, too?
That's what I recommend. For day-to-day use, 30 is at least the least that you would want to do.
And then you would go up from there.
And before I go too much farther, as it turns out, all skin types should be protected, regardless of the skin tone. And the main reason for that is that although some people simply don't burn, we all photoage. So if somebody comes in, they say, look, I've got very darkly pigmented skin. I'm not sure that I have anything really to gain. I say, well, you have every wrinkle to gain in this case. So about half of all the wrinkles we get in our lifetime is because of sun, not because of the calendar. And so it's important to use that as frequently as you need to. As far as my favorite, I look at ingredients. If it's got zinc in it, avobenzone or titanium dioxide, some sort of combination of those things, that's what I look for. Mm. And the one I generally recommend for my sensitive skin patients is going to be either Cetaphil or CeraVe facial moisturizer, the AM one, because they both have a AM and PM.
And that's the other thing that not just ladies, but people in general, you can use them as a moisturizer and make sure that your moisturizer, if you are using it, has a sunblock factor
in it. If your skin is already dry, you might as well be using something that is protecting your skin against too much
sun. It's interesting you mentioned the avobenzone because there are different chemicals in these sunscreens, and over the years, some have gotten out of favor. I remember it used to be, we used to always tell parents, oh, get one that had PABA in it, PABA this, PABA that. And then it was like, oh no, now I'm supposed to say PABA free. So, the recommendations keep changing.
Well, PABA or benzoic acid it's a reasonably good sunscreen, but its main problem is that it was causing allergic contact dermatitis. People were breaking out in rashes saying, I traded one problem for another. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and then you said avobenzone instead of oxybenzone. And I remember when some of these recommendations came out about not using ones with oxybenzone, my daughter called me and went, oh, what are we going to do? Why don't they tell us that ahead of time? Because, again, preschools were being very active in having children, you know, the parents applying the sunscreen before they got there and then, you know, reapplying it. Or allowing, then letting the school know that they were allowed, that they could reapply it. But anyway, I said, when we were young, we used baby oil with iodine in it and a piece of tin foil. So, you know, yes, that was not the right thing to do. But I think, you know, a year of oxybenzone or whatever, unless you ate it, you're probably okay. So...
Yeah, hope, as it turns out, yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of controversy on this, especially recently. Avobenzone is probably the reason that we like that is because it's broad spectrum. The only problem with it is it has to be mixed with something else to stabilize it because it's very photolabile. But once they do that, that you can get a nice, even, broad coverage. With titanium dioxide and especially zinc oxide, the coverage is already there. Its main problem is the opacity issue. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go above 30, then it starts, even in the nanoparticle, that will become opaque again. So to mix and match and get anything higher than about SPF with zinc in it, you have to mix it with something else. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be oxybenzone. It is going to be avobenzone. It is going to be one of the oxycinnamates, something like that. And that's how we can get the 50 and the 55 and the 70 and the 100 SPF, which, you know, it's rapidly approaching, you know, the theoretical limit at that point.
The only problem with the ones with the zinc in them is vinyl in your car. If you put your arm down on the vinyl armrest, you get a kind of a whitish one. So we've been trying to, just take a little towel with us and put that down on the armrest. What about protective clothing? We certainly recommend hats, long sleeves, long pants. What about, and the clothes that are labeled UVA and UVB, do they work and how long do they work or do you have any idea?
One of the things I tell my patients is that clothing is your first line of defense. It is the first and the longest lasting sunscreen. It uses a slightly different coating system. Instead of SPF, it's UPF. It's ultraviolet protective factor. Just about any cloth is going to give you at least 15 mm-hmm. SPF. And although the material itself can be important, believe it or not, it is the tightness of the weave that seems to make the most difference. Now, the Skin Cancer Society does have their own preferences, enough so that they have a program whereby textile manufacturers and clothing manufacturers can get their special seal of approval saying that, yes, we've examined this, you're going to get at least this much. I tell my patients, you know, throw on a rash guard shirt. That's, you know, Derevish, you've been using that for a long, long time. Mm. Preferably one that fits you just right. The super tight ones, once you start stretching the fabric, you've opened the little holes in between the weave, and that's mm-hmm. going to let in a little more UV. So getting the right one, as far as fit is concerned, is important.
Very interesting. Because I was just going to say, rash guards are such an amazing development for kids in, you know, in pools and stuff, because now they have those somewhat tight, maybe they shouldn't be as tight, shirts that they can go right in the water with. Susie, mm-hmm. any comments?
We just received a text from a listener that has a question for Mary. And you may laugh at this question, but she's asking, what do you wear for pickleball? It's one of your pickleball friends, by the way.
I know who that is, yeah. I bet.
And how about sunscreen versus clothing? Kind of have touched on that. I know your answer to that. So there's your question.
Well, so that's so funny. So pickleball, I actually play indoors. So I'm protected. Mm-hmm. And there's a big garage door that we can open up and get ventilation. So that's what I'm using mainly, because when you play pickleball, you do get hot and my arms and limbs are exposed. But yeah, that's funny.
But you wear the best sunblock that you know, that you like applying to your skin, because the most important thing is compliance.
Right. So the answer to the last question is both.
Is do it.
is wear protective clothing and sunscreen.
Yeah. In fact, I was just going to ask you, Mary, we've talked about what brand you found effective, but what do you find effective? How do you encourage compliance and then guesstimate the compliance that you're getting?
Well, obviously sun protection is something that's brought up with every client. If they're going to say, Mary, I'm going to the beach, well, then at least can they spend part of the time in the shade? Do we need to break? Okay, sorry. So if they can spend part of the time in the shade or wear clothing if they're going to be outside and reapplying the SPF.
All important.
Mm-hmm. All important.
Little discussion about tanning beds, because it's been so interesting over the last 10 to 15 years how it's now become part of regulations. Basically, they emit UVA light, and they've been linked to melanoma in younger age groups. In 2009, a study showed that the risk of melanoma increased by 75% in those who used tanning beds when they were younger than age 30. So, you guys, how many people ask you about tanning beds?
Well, in my particular situation, it's sometimes hard for them to admit that they did the tanning bed thing. Whereas the teenagers nowadays that I see in the clinic are more than happy to tell me, yeah, I use the tanning bed, but how can I use it safely? And I say, with it turned off, probably the best. A lot of times, telling them that it's going to cause skin cancer later oftentimes falls on deaf ears, mainly because, that's when I'm going to be, old like you. And I tell them, look, it is the number one contributor to photoaging your skin. When you're 30, you're going to look 45, so don't do it. If you want your skin to look nice all the way through your life, you're going to want to protect it.
And yeah. So a lot of what we experience as we get older with skin problems and wrinkles and things like that, or cancer, we'll probably get into that, were really put in place when we were younger.
Yes.
And Joanne and I are of the age where we didn't even know any of this information. For the kids today, we could have a new trend. Pale is hip.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman is in. Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah. Because 50% of indoor tanners started before age 21. And now in some states, they are restricting the use to 18 and up unless your parents sign, because I know I hate to admit this, my granddaughter went before, like, homecoming to it.
Oh, boy.
Sure.
It's been very popular for providers to check vitamin D levels on patients. So let's talk a little bit about vitamin D, and if you're too compliant, reapply, and you never get any sun, does that affect your vitamin D level, especially now that more and more women are being diagnosed with osteoporosis, and we have the DEXA scan that can test it. So as I say in medicine, a lot of things we have now that we didn't even know about 30, 40, 50 years ago is because we have new tests. So the more you can test, the more illnesses or diseases or situations you can name. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about vitamin D and how do we ensure that people do get vitamin D?
So some people believe the best way to get vitamin D is from the sun, that we make it through our skin. Where we live, we only make it a few months out of the year around the summer solstice, which is right where we're at. But that doesn't mean we want to promote skin cancer. Like, you really only need 15 to 20 minutes three times a week, and then get out of the sun if you're going to be doing it, if you want to get your vitamin D through the sun. So most people need to rely on supplementation of vitamin D to help the bone health as well as the brain health and your immune system functioning, your bone health, like everything helps your mood. So by no means do we say you need to stay out all day, because at a certain point you stop. You make a certain amount and then you stop through your skin.
You start anyway. Really needing it.
Yeah, you've kind of saturated the system at that point.
So,
as far as the theoretical risk from sunscreens are concerned, they jumped on the American Academy of Dermatology jumped on that fairly rapidly, and the research is pretty clear that the way that people, normal people, use sunscreen does not prevent vitamin D from being produced in the body. There is a theoretical risk for people who absolutely cannot be in the sun. There are some skin disorders where that is absolutely the case, but as it turns out, using sunscreen is not going to keep you from vitamin D production. And if you have low levels, you're going to have to look elsewhere for the problem. Yeah.
And usually you can't get enough vitamin D through food, even if you there's not enough food sources that are going to get
you
the level that
you
need.
So supplementation is important.
Yeah.
But do be sure that you, if you're drinking milk or eating this or eating that, that some say vitamin D added with vitamin D. And I would recommend that you at least are aware of what calcium product you have and if it has been fortified with vitamin D. Okay, let's get into skin cancer, because that's really why we're talking about all of this. We want people to be healthy, and we want to prevent basically skin cancer by using sunblock and horrible, nasty burns that I remember when we would go to Florida to my mother-in-law's place. Some of us, whether it be your children or myself, would get a burn, and it would be like, oh, you know, sit in a cold bath or apply vinegar or something like that.
But Noxzema.
My husband's friends got, one of them were really allergic to cane drugs and put on solar cane. And that was a more uncomfortable night than using grin and bear it, I guess. And it does get better. But so we want to prevent burns, and we want to prevent burns because that's how most people get skin cancer. So it's the most common cancer in both U.S. and the world. 1 in 5 people in the U.S. develop skin cancer by the age of 70. And we do know the UV rays are damaging our DNA and causing mutations. The body repairs some do go on to basal cells, squamous cell, and melanoma. So actually back in 1982, when the SPF factor was being developed, a study was released that 56% of melanoma patients had a history of a severe sunburn, compared to only 22% of controls who were matched for your skin color, your eye color, your hair color, because that really determines your response to sun exposure and habitat. Although we say, as Richard said, even if you're dark skinned, you need to use sunblock. So, Mary, how do you determine a patient needs a referral to a dermatology practice? And do you use the ABCDE system and location?
Yeah, absolutely. So ABCDE, the medical world loves acronyms. So A stands for asymmetry, how one side looks. Does it look different than the other side? B is border irregularity, like a smoother oval is not as concerning as if it's very irregular or notched. C is color. Is it always been a black mole or discoloration, and now is it red? Is it white? Is it gray? Or was it gray and now turning different color? Diameter is typically concerning if it's 6 millimeters or larger, which is the diameter of a pencil eraser. So if it's getting bigger, that's more of a concern. And then E just stands for evolution. And really, that's how I could have just said it. Like, if there's any change in skin, that should be cause for concern. Is it scaly? Is it bleeding spontaneously? Those would be things that would be of concern. So really, any change. That's what you have to, the take-home message is that. And we should do monthly skin checks. If you can't check your back with a mirror, then have a friend, have a spouse, have a neighbor check it if you can't do it yourself. But it needs to be a head-to-toe skin check, because you can get skin changes anywhere, not just the sun-exposed areas.
Do you also recommend a once-a-year skin check with a professional?
Well, for high-risk people, Rich, you can take this over. But yeah.
Yeah, so, generally speaking, I do.
How many, Mary, can you estimate or guesstimate how many you end up referring over a year?
I don't know. So typically people have already been in, already established with a skin provider. And one time there's already one suspicious lesion, then it's just like you go once a year, unless you're being monitored more closely. So
should we look at specific locations, Richard? Like,
oh, certainly. Sun-exposed areas are obviously going to be the areas of most concern because those are the ones that have had that sort of exposure. And I would add that just because something has changed doesn't necessarily mean it's become malignant. There are a lot of lesions that we pick up that are new, that are perfectly harmless. They're simply incident to genetics and aging and normal processes in life. So just because something has changed, don't freak out, but do get it checked.
So catching it early makes a huge difference.
It certainly can. It certainly can.
How many of the referrals that you get from private practitioners or just practitioners in any clinic, how many do you get that are positive or concerning to you then?
I'd say that the vast majority will have lesions that when they come in and I take a look at them with a dermatoscopic exam are perfectly normal. They're not problematic. They can be treated if they are a functional issue, but are otherwise perfectly harmless. But I'd say about 1 in 20 to 1 in 15, they come in and whoever referred them hit it right on the nose. Now, the nice thing is that if these things are small, sometimes we can take care of them at that visit. Other times we can at least do a biopsy and figure out what's going on because it's important to know, you know, what you're treating. But beyond that, you get them into this sort of cycle where they know that they need to be keeping an eye on their skin and catching things early.
Again, there are multiple types of skin cancer. We worry most about melanoma because that seems to be the one that can
metastasize and
cause eventual death. There's a new one now called Merkel cell, which I had never heard of, and a friend ended up, two people have had it, and it's more of a fleshy kind of bulbous thing.
Yes, Merkel cell carcinoma is not common. I've been doing this going on 30 years now, and I've diagnosed maybe two or three of these, so it's a once-a-decade thing, but they are very aggressive, and oftentimes, I'd say a majority of the time, the practitioner that actually biopsies them think that it is a basal cell carcinoma. So even though basal cells are generally fairly easy to treat, you don't have fatalities associated with them with other ones, you're always biopsying them and treating them because you're not sure that it might not be one of these Merkel cell carcinomas, and they are very aggressive. Very aggressive.
Yeah. Why don't we go back to the ones that are more common, basal cell, squamous cell, and then melanoma. Tell us what you're looking for. It's probably exactly what Mary was looking for, but how you go, that really, you want to either freeze it, scrape it to biopsy, or refer back up to people who would even do more procedures.
Well, as far as people just looking at their own skin, the type of lesions that they're looking for, it would be something that does not heal. Even if you may already have a reason for thinking it might be something else. For example, let's say that you scraped yourself on your arm and it just, you know, and that was 3 months ago and it still hasn't healed. Sometimes trauma in an area of previous sun exposure can elicit these. Other things that that can be concerning, something that grows quickly, something that bleeds easily.
Mary, our nurse practitioner, has to go see some patients so she can refer them on to Richard. or at least help them as we're getting warmer in Sandpoint. Because Sandpoint is such a beautiful place and people want to be outside winter and summer. We even need protection in the winter. So I want to thank Mary a lot for coming and giving her perspective on what the practitioner looks at before they make the derm referral. So thank you, Mary.
Of course. Thank you. All right. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Okay, so back to skin lesions that are worrisome.
Yes, most of the time these are going to they're going to have certain characteristics that you would expect. They're not going to heal. They're not going to look the same. Basal cell carcinomas are a little different than squamous cell carcinomas in that they're usually painless. They may bleed easily, and they may even ulcerate. And it looks like they should hurt like crazy, but they don't. Oftentimes, they are completely painless. They'll say, "Well, I didn't think anything of it because it doesn't hurt." Well, sometimes that's because it's chewed up the nerve endings there, and you're not feeling anything, and that's the reason why. Squamous cell carcinoma oftentimes does hurt. It's oftentimes irritating, particularly when you get hot and sweaty, for example. So you can't use the symptoms necessarily as a good gauge of whether or not it's malignant. But anything that grows quickly should be checked, because both of these can grow very quickly, especially a lesion that's been stable for a while. I would say the same thing about melanoma. You may have had this mole for 10, 15, 20 years, and all of a sudden it changes. It goes to town on your skin and is growing like crazy. Yeah, that obviously needs to be checked.
So you're looking, again, for the irregular borders turning usually more black or just changing in color?
Changing in color. You're looking for a change because certain types of melanomas, the cells are so abnormal that they no longer produce pigment. We call those amelanotic melanomas, and those ones can be difficult to find either because people, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be this darkening. It went from kind of a light tan to a dark brown and then black. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then you have these other ones where the mole just looked like it lost all of its pigment. Why did this happen? Well, it might be a benign change, or it could be one of these amelanotic melanomas.
What procedures do you do in the office yourself, and then who do you need to refer up to a dermatologist that maybe does Mohs, or do you do Mohs, or tell us about Mohs?
Mohs surgery. It is a surgical procedure that was created by a surgeon by the name of Friedrich Mohs, and its claim to fame is that when you take the lesion out, you process it there before the patient even leaves, and it's done in such a way that it can be sectioned and stained so we know exactly where any residual cancer may be. So instead of having to take a bigger and bigger chunk, basically you know where to take that little extra, and that's important if you're going to have a good cosmetic outcome. Now for the back, the chest, the shoulders, areas like this, oftentimes it's just a matter of taking large enough margin that you can be sure you got it all. But on the face, the ears, especially the nose, the forehead, these are areas you want to preserve as much as possible normal skin so you can have a good cosmesis or a good cosmetic outcome. And that's really where melanoma does. And it's kind of nice to know that there's a 99% chance that there's no cancer the minute you leave the clinic. That's a good thing.
So one of the things when they do a biopsy, say it's mm-hmm. on the arm where you're not concerned about the cosmetic mm-hmm. aspect, and they take quite a big chunk out mm-hmm. because they already know they did an original biopsy and it was something that they needed to take out, they would take a larger margin, but they still check those margins to make sure they've got it all.
Absolutely.
So is that done at the time, or is that what Mohs is? They're doing it in real time.
In Mohs, that's when they're doing it real time. Whereas a standard excisional surgery, you will go ahead and take a look at the lesion, and you would measure out the margin, take it out, and send it for pathology. And most of the time, that's good enough.
It's clear.
Yeah, it's clear. And if a lesion is small enough or superficial enough, let's say that somebody comes in and they have what appears to be a small basal cell carcinoma, it's kind of pearly colored, it's got these weird blood vessels in it that you can see when you examine it under magnification, then when I scoop it off, oftentimes I will do what's called an EDNC, an electrodesiccation and curettage, which is scraping off the rest of it. And you can tell where the normal skin is because it has a very different texture when you're doing the procedure. And even though it has a slightly lower cure rate, it oftentimes like how often, like 96 to 97% of the time in given lesions, you can actually be pretty sure that you got it all. And for a patient who has a busy lifestyle, would rather not have to come back for another procedure, oftentimes that's enough. It may not be, but it's something that you can do.
Okay, so if I had a lesion that I was worried about, or my primary care doctor saw a lesion that they were worried about, and I was referred to you, and you were worried about it, do you then scrape and then send that to pathology and then go on and electrodesiccate the rest? Is that what you're saying? I just want to be able to visualize it or help our listeners visualize it.
Yeah, it depends on the lesion itself. If I think it's a small pencil eraser size basal cell carcinoma, which I see fairly frequently, then simply burning and scraping it off while waiting for path is a perfectly logical thing.
So you send a specimen first before you do
that? That's right. Okay. I scoop it off and I send it, and then we do the ED&C if that's appropriate.
Take it to the bottom.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And then who do you refer up to your dermatologist?
If it ends up being someplace, and there's a whole schema or a protocol that you follow for those things that are best treated with Mohs, I send it to one of my colleagues down in Coeur d'Alene, where we have a Mohs clinic. Okay. On the second floor, we have a Mohs clinic with a full-size lab and everything that is needed to complete Mohs procedures.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about aging and brown spots and things like that. And just, again, another little, maybe it's not funny, but it's kind of funny. As I was talking to my high school friends and people were getting cataracts done, they said the only disadvantage of getting their cataracts done is they could see their wrinkles more. So, again, there are many women and men, too, are worried about brown spots, aging skin in general. Do you recommend anything to purchase? Do you get lots of requests for retinoid kinds of prescriptions? And what do we need to know about that?
Yes. Well, obviously, the most important thing from my perspective is to protect your skin from ongoing damage. Believe it or not, there are always horses in the barn. So so just because you think, no, it's too late. No, it's not too late. Unless you're already, well into your 90s, you're 100 years old, there's still some things that you should do to protect your skin. Now, having said that, yes, I am a big believer in the retinoids, whether you get it over the counter as retinol or any one of the retinoids that are available as a prescription, tretinoin, Tazoract, I shouldn't use trade names, Tazarotene, Adapalene. All of these have some favorable things about them. First, it makes your skin look better. Second, it helps with acne blemishes and things like that. And it tends to suppress precancerous changes, the actinic keratoses that some of our patients don't like having frozen or having to use the chemotherapy cream that we give them. If you want to suppress those, one of the best things you can do is to use a topical retinoid. There is one over-the-counter topical retinoid you can get other than retinol, and that is Adapalene. It is marketed under the name Differin, and it's in the acne section.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a topical retinoid, and although we don't have a whole lot of studies as far as photodamage is concerned, the mechanism of action is the same as these other ones and should do at least a reasonably good job for those folks who want to give it a try.
See, that's so interesting because those were all acne medicines when I was in practice, and then they went to the ladies who wanted them, but Adapalene.
Yeah, when Renova came out for the fine lines and wrinkles, that's true.
Yeah. And so, but what about the things that are really just cosmetic and it says night cream or something like that? Is there really a benefit to some of those expensive over-the-counter, cosmetics?
To the extent that they want you to think so, I would say that's a little controversial. What I think they do, the better ones, the ones with agents that tend to bind water in the skin, like salicylic acid, glycolic acid, hyaluronic acid, things like this, they will have your skin hold on to more water, and as it does, it plumps it out and gets rid of some of these wrinkles. Now, it's a temporary phenomenon, but it's reasonable to say that, yes, it helps some. Okay. It's not like, you know, like laser resurfacing or some of the other things that are available cosmetically. But
that sounds like you and I agree. Is there anything else that we should remind our listeners? The biggest thing I imagine is that winter and summer, they need protection. Use your sunscreen in the winter, too, especially when you're skiing or, you know, where you're up at a higher elevation, skiing.
All of the worst facial sunburns that I have seen have been during the winter time, with people who are out on the slopes and they're trucking, you know, down Schweitzer, and it's cold air in their face. They don't feel it. And keep in mind that both water and snow reflect UV, so they get a lot of reflected UV, and that they come in and I say, okay, well, let's see if we can't make you more comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the three things are clothing is your number one protection. Use the highest SPF of sunscreen that you can tolerate. The reason being that, you know, the SPF is under laboratory conditions. Keep that in mind. So if it says 30, most people would put it on and get 15 out of that, maybe half of that. And get your skin checked by your spouse on a monthly basis, or whoever can look at your back and the back of your legs and areas where you can't see, and at least once a year by your medical provider if they feel comfortable in doing skin exams.
Or send you to a dermatologist so you can have your skin checked.
There you go.
Once a year.
Here's what I've been told. If you have a concern, don't hesitate. Go get it checked.
That's right.
And don't forget to put sunscreen on your hands.
Yes.
It's not, you don't think of your hands. They're tough.
Mm-hmm.
They're not. They have a thicker layer to them. You don't think that that could be a place where cancer might show up. But
see it all the time.
Yeah. You know. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Richard, so much for being here with me today. I really wanted to feature July. I don't, my voice, as UV Awareness Month. So I'm really happy that I have such a knowledgeable person here to interview.
No, thank you very much. It's been nice being here.
All right. I'm going to just do two little short other programs. July 15th is Global Hug Your Kid Day. So, Susie, what do you think of that? In 2008, Michelle Nichols designated the third Monday in July as Global Hug Your Kids Day. In recognition of her son's death at 1998 at age 8 of brain cancer, Michelle has also written a book called Hug Your Kids Today. In 1986, a day in January was designated as National Hugging Day, but not specific for children. Hugs are practiced by almost all cultures. They reflect reassurance, comfort, safety, trust, sympathy, and empathy. And hugga is a Norse word that means to comfort. So the word hug has been used since the 1600s. Hugging is actually good for you as it produces oxytocin from the pituitary that regulates your blood pressure, your heart rate, and the stress hormone cortisol. Decreases anxiety, improves mood, memory, and increases binding and bonding and closeness. Hugging can increase your O2 levels, calm your breathing, ease pain, decrease infections, and increase brain growth. The record for the most hugs set in 2019 is 138 in a minute.
That's a lot of hugs.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So what do you have to say about that, Susie?
Well, I know when a child is born, all you want to do is hold that baby. And I really always believed, and I still do, that a baby should be held as much as possible by as many people in its inner circle, held tightly, you know, wrapped up nicely and held and not put down in a crib somewhere to just be there. Holding a baby is basically another way of hugging them. And they thrive. And I think it's a way to have young children and babies thrive. And that bonding thing is crucial. And I imagine that they have a different outlook as life unfolds for them. So Hugging is the best thing. We all know what it feels like to get a hug. Someone opens up their arms and says, give me a hug. And it feels great. So,
well, it's interesting because you really hit upon one of the, their one list says there are five facts about hugging. So makes a child smarter as it's an important stimulus to grow a healthy brain. So all that holding and loving when they were an infant is really helping us grow a healthy brain. It alleviates phobias by decreasing a person's existential fears. Well-hugged babies are less stressed adults. You must have read this.
No, I just observed it forever.
And it teaches children how to deal with stress as an adult. Interesting. Most people hug with the right hand leading.
That's interesting.
And it decreases social anxiety. So actually, looks like you said you didn't read the same reference that I read, but it just came from
common sense.
Right. And observation of people in the world.
And how we feel, like I said, when we get a hug. It's great.
So let's everybody go out and hug someone today. Except the hugging day is July 15th, but you're not limited to only July 15th. You can hug every day, any day you want, 8 times a minute if you wish. There's also another day in July, Sunday, July 21st, is National Ice Cream Day. So we have a little history about National Ice Cream Day. I couldn't do this without checking some history. The third Sunday in July was designated as National Ice Cream Day by Ronald Reagan in 1984. It has been extended by some to National Ice Cream Month. Ice cream is a nutritious and wholesome food enjoyed by 90% of people in the U.S., and if you're lactose intolerant, there are lactose-free products that you can also consume. Sherbet is not lactose-free, so I've always had people ask me that, and just to verify or remind people that sherbet is not, but the fruit ices are. Alexander the Great, who lived from 356 to 323 B.C., liked snow and ice with nectar and honey. So he had some kind of ice cream. Julius Caesar lived from 100 to 44 B.C., and he gathered snow from the mountains and covered it in fruit and their juices. In China, somewhere between 618 and 697 A.D., we've now moved into A.D., there was an ice cream-like product made with flour and buffalo milk and camphor. I'm not sure about the camphor, but anyway. So remember, we will all go out and have ice cream on Sunday, July 21st.
And or July 4th.
It's coming up, right? Yep, that's in July and a great holiday to eat ice cream. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Please do remember this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. So I hope we've answered some questions and emphasized the importance of using sunscreen when you go out in this beautiful playground we have here in North Idaho. Please tune in next month on August 5th, when we'll be discussing Women's Equality Month with Jen Jackson Quintano, founder of the Pro Voice Project. And again, back to Susie. Any questions, or are you going to play some music for us?
Well, I think that I'd just like to say that we will be rebroadcasting this show on the 15th of July, because that's our rebroadcast day. So if you didn't hear it, you can go to our website at krfy.org. Find it as a podcast or listen in again on the 15th of July. And I think that's it. Joanne, thank you so much for producing this show that is a valuable reference system for our listeners here at KRFY.
Happy to do so. I just love working with the public and imparting some medical knowledge to them that can really help.
Thank you.